Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
$500,000 a year, not a penny more for bankers taking bailout money. That's what the president said today. And even that's a huge amount of money. But other than making headlines, what are the new rules really going to do? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday. It's the 4th of February today. In a way, the president did the easiest thing first. He went after the guys at the top, bankers who make all the money, who are going to be making less of it now. But our Washington bureau chief John Dimsdale reports there is less to the president's new rules than you might imagine.
President Obama says public outrage over bonuses for bankers that get bailouts is undermining the trust needed to resuscitate the economy.
This is America. We don't disparage wealth. We don't begrudge anybody for achieving success. And we certainly believe that success should be rewarded. But what gets people upset, and rightfully so, are executives being rewarded for failure.
But the new pay caps are limited to companies that take exceptional amounts of bailout money, companies like Citigroup or Bank of America that were on the verge of collapse. Only the top five executives are covered, and they can still earn unlimited amounts of stock as long as they don't cash it in until the bailout money is paid back. For some, the president's crackdown is more style than substance. Still, Marilyn Cohen at Envision Capital Management says the president got Wall Street's attention.
Within just a few minutes of the president's announcement, there was news that Goldman Sachs would like to pay back its TARP money. Well, guess why? They want to continue to grease their palms just like the old days, and the message is loud and clear. The old days are over.
Executive pay consultant James Rita says the limits will make banks reconsider taking federal money.
In the future, if someone's faced with the idea of falling under the exceptional assistance or going bankrupt, they might consider going bankrupt because they would be treated more fairly. I mean, a bankrupt company's CEOs make more than $500,000 a year, I can tell you that.
Next week, the president announces proposals for longer-term limits on corporate salaries, including giving shareholders a non-binding vote on executive pay. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The Securities and Exchange Commission doesn't usually get all that much attention, but you put a whistleblower in front of a congressional committee and attention you will get. Harry Markopoulos spent 10 years trying to get regulators to look into disgraced money manager Bernie Madoff, without much luck, though.
I gift-wrapped and delivered the largest Ponzi scheme in history to them, and somehow they couldn't be bothered to conduct a thorough and proper investigation because they were too busy on matters of higher priority.
Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has our story.
Members of Congress were stunned by Harry Markopoulos' testimony today. Markopoulos said it took him 5 minutes to determine that Bernie Madoff's fund was a fraud.
And I wish I had a whiteboard and an easel here, but I don't, so I'm going to give you a hand signal, and I'm going to show you what his performance return line looked like. It was a 45-degree angle without any variation. It went in only one direction, up.
Markopoulos' allegations sent members of Congress yelling at SEC officials. That's nothing new to Stanley Sporkin, a former director of the SEC's Division of Enforcement. He says the agency has always been a whipping boy.
It's probably a year ago when the top officials in Washington were complaining about the SEC being too tough and that all the business was going to go to London and that you had to cut back on regulation.
Borkin says if anything, the SEC needs more authority. Steve Thiel teaches securities regulation at Fordham Law School. He says the SEC may get it, but in some areas it may have to cede authority to the Fed.
It's pretty clear that the SEC was an ineffective regulator of the capital of investment banks. But at the same time, it's likely that the kind of authority that the SEC might have used to pursue Madoff, the commission's going to continue to have in all likelihood, and in fact, is probably going to get more.
Thiel says the agency's problem isn't the amount of power it has, but rather the ideologies of some of its commissioners.
For the last few years, it has moved away from trying to enforce the laws towards a skepticism of the very idea of regulation at the top.
Congress tried unsuccessfully to boost the agency's budget last year, but today's showdown may have whet Washington's appetite for another try. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
You've heard, perhaps, that we need to raise a whole pile of money to pay for all the government's bailouts. Today, the Treasury announced its plan to do that. It's going to double sales of the 30-year bond. It's bringing back the 7-year note. There's even talk about creating 4, 20, and 50-year bonds. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
The government already issues 2-year, 3-year, 5-year, 10-year, and 30-year bonds. So why would we need a 7-year bond? Guy Labat is chief fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott.
The 7-year bonds may be, for example, used to fund TARP investment in corporations, whereas the 20-year bonds might be used effectively to fund deficits that they expect to be able to repay more distantly in the future.
Labat says differing maturities can bring in more investors.
So the Treasury would go out with, for example, $30 billion worth of 2-year bonds. But if that number went up to $40 billion, well, maybe you couldn't muster enough investors in a given day to be interested. But if you have a 2-year and a 3-year and a 5-year and a 7-year all on separate days, it's a more efficient way to get the auctions completed.
Labat says some investors need the quick payoff of a 2-year note. Others are willing to take a 30-year gamble, but they demand higher returns. Investors will get their first crack at a 7-year note on February 26th. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Bond prices fell today. So did stocks. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a concept in business called vertical integration, when a single company controls both production and distribution of whatever it's selling. That's what popped into my mind this morning as I was browsing the Wall Street Journal. The paper says two major players in the music industry are about to come together. The world's biggest concert promoter, Live Nation, and the ticketing and management giant Ticketmaster are in merger talks, apparently. If it comes to pass, such a deal would create a single company that could handle almost every aspect of a recording artist's career. That's one of the benefits of vertical integration. But it could also potentially drown out any competition, a downside of integration that's called antitrust. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
If the $740 million merger goes through, Live Nation and Ticketmaster would have ties to more than 200 artists like Madonna, Jay-Z, and Miley Cyrus. The company would manage albums, concerts, careers, and ticket sales. Bob Lefsetz is a music industry analyst.
They solve each other's problems. Live Nation can get rid of its own ticketing system that does not work. Ticketmaster can broaden their reach. It's about making it so that Wall Street believes there's more profitability.
And profitability for both companies has been a problem. Concert attendance is slipping, CD sales are dropping by about 20% a year, and downloads aren't making up the difference. To get more, music companies are cobbling together revenues from merchandise, sponsorships, and online sales, says Russ Krupnik, an analyst with NPD Entertainment.
The industry had one product, and that one product was the CD. And where the industry is starting to evolve to is a web of all of these smaller revenue streams.
And the biggest of those is concerts, says analyst Bob Lefsetz.
Concert used to be the ad for the album. Now the album is the ad for the concert.
Lefsetz says together, Live Nation and Ticketmaster could push smaller promoters out and dictate ticket prices. That could be a deal breaker for regulators worried about a music monopoly. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The White House said today it's asked the Pentagon to trim its budget request for next year by $60 billion from recent forecasts. That would put the defense budget at $527 billion, not counting Iraq and Afghanistan. Some of the fighting in those wars isn't happening over there. It's being waged from hundreds or sometimes thousands of miles away, robotically. P.W. Singer's new book about technology and national defense is called Wired for War. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Is this development that you write about, is it technology for technology's sake or technology as an effective weapon of war?
My sense is that we're experiencing a historic revolution right now, probably on the level of the atomic bomb or even more, because it's not just changing how we fight, but who fights at the most fundamental level, where we have people that are at war, but they're not physically at war. They're really sitting at home. It's creating all sorts of psychological disconnects, challenges. You know, there's a Predator drone pilot who put it this way to me. You're going to war for 12 hours, shooting weapons at targets, directing kills on enemy combatants, and then you get in the car and you drive home. And within 20 minutes, you're sitting at the dinner table talking to your kids about their homework.
And maybe it's not too surprising, given one of the anecdotes you start with in this book, and that's about a weapon of war, one of these robots, made by the same company that makes the Roomba, that little vacuum cleaner thing.
Yeah, I joke that iRobot, the company that makes it, is the only business that sells both to the Pentagon and to Lennon's and things.
The logical extension of all of this, of course, is the fear of the Terminator showing up on the battlefield.
Or showing up at your door.
Yeah, well, that's right. That would be worse, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't think we're at that kind of revolution yet. But what is somewhat interesting is that when I went around interviewing all these various scientists and Pentagon folks, you know, I call this issue the Lord Voldemort issue. It's like the Harry Potter series where there's the issue that shall not be discussed. And it's arming autonomous robots. We don't like to talk about it, but the reality is that first, our war logic is taking us down that pathway right now, where, for example, we say, you know what, you don't get any personnel savings if you just have one guy controlling one robot. It's got to be one guy with 10 robots. Well, that means you have to make them a little bit autonomous. Or they say, well, you know, there's an enemy, and if the enemy can cut the controller out of the loop, then that'll end the use of the robot. So we need to give them that kind of autonomy.
This is what the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, might call, not to put words in his mouth, but it is a force multiplier, right? When you have an army that is stretched so thin, if you can get robots doing what human soldiers would ordinarily have to do, then that is a net savings.
There are hundreds of Americans, if not thousands of Americans, that are alive right now because of robots taking over their roles and things like defusing IEDs in Iraq. But there's the flip side to that equation, which is, does it make you cavalier about the use of force? In a democracy, you know, the concern is to keep your public linked with your military and your defense policy. What happens as you move more and more people out of harm's way? You know, we already don't have a draft. We don't buy war bonds. And so you may have these already lowering bars to war hit the ground.
For good or ill, though, this all sort of was inevitable, wasn't it, from the time we first started building machines?
I think it is. And this question of for good or ill really does encapsulate it. We have incredible creativity, and we've used it to do things like to take our species to the stars. And yet we are also using this creativity to create this new technology that one day may even be a new species. Who knows? But right now, it's certainly fantastic. But the reason that we're doing it is because of war. And so it raises this question as to whether it's our machines that are wired for war or is it us?
P.W. Singer is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His book about robotics and the military is called Wired for War. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, farmers stretch the growing season and their dollars.
Now, if you do the economics of it, for $10,000, we have this structure. And by year two, I will have netted enough to have paid for the structure.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials left behind 121 points today, 1.5%, ended the day at 79.56. The NASDAQ lost a point, closing basically flat, 1550 in the number. The S&P 500 threw off 6 points, 0.75%, closed at 832. Kraft Foods left a bad taste in investors' mouths after saying profits would come in below forecast. Kraft dropped 9% today. Disney missed estimates for its first quarter sales and profits. Its stock fell by more than 7% as revenue shrank at TV networks, theme parks, and the film studio. Costco bit off 6.8% today. The giant warehouse club chain said earnings per share for the second quarter would be a lot lower than analyst estimates. Bank of America declined another 11% today. Investors are fretting as they wait for details of a new government plan to take money-losing assets off bank books. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. What's the connection between Girl Scout cookies and margin calls? Check out the Marketplace Decoder on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis. Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its preliminary report on fourth quarter productivity and costs. The Commerce Department reports on factory orders for December. And major retailers report January sales figures. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The president said today we risk, and this is his word now, not mine, catastrophe if Congress doesn't pass his stimulus bill soon. The plan at the moment is to have it ready for him next week, but with the balance due on the Senate version north of $900 billion and rising, the political infighting is nowhere near done. Commentator David Frum says when we're spending that much money, we ought to be taking a closer look.
In his inaugural address, President Obama promised to restore science to its rightful place. This stimulus package, working its way toward his desk, presents a great opportunity to start. The Democratic majority in the House of Representatives has voted $819 billion in new spending, ostensibly to fight the economic downturn. Critics and skeptics see the vote as Democratic boondoggling on a galactic scale. Defenders reply that these critics belong to the party of Herbert Hoover, disregarding the crisis in the name of obsolete ideology. Economics is not a science exactly, but it does have enough scientific elements that it might contribute something useful to the debate. Before the president signs anything, why don't we assemble a panel of distinguished economists, say the past half dozen chairs of the President's Council of Economic Advisers, plus all the American Nobel Prize winners, to rate the different spending measures in the stimulus package according to how many jobs they will deliver at how much cost. My guess is that we'll find that while a minority of the spending will generate a reasonable return in the form of higher employment and faster growth, the majority of it is waste that will actually harm economic performance by shifting dollars from better to worse uses. But maybe that's just the kind of cynicism that President Obama deplored in his inaugural address. So let's deploy some real expertise. Then let's make use of that expertise and refrain from spending unnecessary money. President Obama reportedly told Republican members of Congress that he does not think there is much waste in the federal budget. Even if he were right about that now, and he's not, he certainly will not be right after Congress adds another $1 trillion in spending. That waste will be hard to eliminate once added. It's easier to suppress before it begins. This is supposed to be a brainy administration. It should not allow its budget policy to be made in the old manner of Tammany Hall. But that's what we are getting. And we will be sorry.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His most recent book is called Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Whether you think David's on point or not, there is at least one thing we can all agree on, that it is really hard to agree on what is or isn't good stimulus. Diane Lim Rogers is the chief economist at the Concord Coalition. When we got her on the line, she said whether the package works or not all starts with that definition.
The current debate in Washington is not over something that we're calling stimulus any longer. It's over a package that we're calling the Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And because of that, it has sort of morphed from what was initially supposed to be just a short-term boost to the level of economic activity to something that suggests that it will leave us in a better place for the longer-term economy. So that complicates the question. If their intention is to primarily boost the short-term economy as quickly as possible, the mix of policies that you'd come up with would be quite different from if the goal were to promote longer-term economic growth.
Well, break it down for me then. What is good stimulus?
Well, short-term stimulus is about immediately as possible, boosting the level of economic activity in the economy. When an economy is in recession, there's unused capacity in the economy. It's not that we don't have the capacity in terms of a labor force and a capital stock. We have buildings, we have land, we have natural resources, we have workers that are available to produce goods and services, but we're not employing all of those resources. So the issue is, for the short-term stimulus, how can we most quickly employ those underused resources? How can we get businesses to invest more and make more purchases in terms of goods and services? How can we get government to directly purchase goods and services? That's what will employ those underutilized resources.
What about the other big part of this stimulus package, tax cuts, right? There's government spending and then there's tax cuts. Will those tax cuts do anything in the short term, say within a year, to get the economy going again?
Well, here's the general problem I have with tax cuts. Tax cuts are an indirect way for government to immediately boost economic activity. Because as I said, to immediately boost economic activity, you have to create demand for goods and services quickly. If the government instead directly hires workers that become government workers, or directly contracts for roads and bridges to be built in terms of direct government spending, that's a one-for-one immediate dollar-for-dollar increase in GDP, in economic activity, because the government is directly purchasing those goods and services, not relying on businesses and households to purchase the goods and services.
Why do you suppose it is, given all the economists running around Washington and folks on the staff in the Senate and the House, that nobody is making the case for more short-term spending if stimulus is what we're trying to get out of this bill?
Well, short-term spending doesn't sound very glamorous and it doesn't sound very worthy. I think that what explains the mix of things currently being considered in the recovery package is not what is likely to actually have the most stimulative effect on the immediate-term economy, but it's a combination of the politics of what President Obama promised on the campaign trail and a need for politicians to signal to the American public that they're doing spending that's worth taxpayer money. And I think there's sometimes a tension between those two goals.
Diane Lim Rogers is the chief economist at the Concord Coalition. She's got a blog, too. It's at economistmom.com, and you can find a link to that on our website, which is, of course, marketplace.org. Diane, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm gave her State of the State address earlier this week. As you might have figured, in a state that's been walloped by the combination of the recession and Detroit's continuing problems, it was a grim affair, not much extra money for anything at all. So if you've been putting off your dream of seeing the world's largest stove at the Michigan State Fair, you better act quickly. Granholm wants to cut the fair. This summer's will be the last. When it started 160 years ago, it was a way for farmers to keep up to date on agricultural technology. In present-day Michigan, fair or no, farmers are still innovating. Way up near the northern tip of Michigan's mitten, they figured out how to stretch their growing season with plastic. Lou Bluen introduces us to something called hoop house farming.
A hoop house isn't much more than big sheets of plastic stretched, covered wagon style, over a series of metal arches. But these no-tech greenhouses can trap enough heat from the sun and soil to keep things like spinach, kale, and even salad greens growing well into the winter.
What would you say the temperature is in here right now?
I don't know. I'm sort of a bad judge. I've been crawling around in the snow. It feels kind of warm.
Nick Welty runs the garden operation at Black Star Farms in rural northwest Michigan.
I don't know. It might be 40 or so. I mean, if it's real sunny, which we haven't had yet, it'll be up to 85.
Like a lot of farmers, Welty doubles the economic punch of the farm's hoop house by using it to grow tomatoes in the summer, in addition to cool weather crops in the winter.
Now, if you do the economics of it, for $10,000, we have this structure. And by year two, I will have netted enough to have paid for the structure.
Those numbers made sense to Jenny Tutlis and John Watts of nearby Meadowlark Farm. They have two hoop houses and are able to deliver fresh veggies to customers into January.
For us, the significance financially for our family is like huge. You know, we make a living now from our farm, and we don't have to work off farm.
Tutlis and her husband, John Watts, can afford the investment into hoop houses largely because of their business model called CSA, or Community Supported Agriculture. With CSA, people invest in the farm up front as shareholders and get a box of food every week as a return on that investment. Most important, says Watts, investors shoulder risk right alongside farmers, which is no small thing when it comes to winter growing.
We had a really bad northwester in the spring, and our straps broke on our roll-up vent on the side, and so the snow came in and killed everything in the house.
I came in right away and just wrote to the shareholders that were expecting to get greens the next week. And everyone was really like, we understand, you know, this is a risk and we're in it with you and it's okay. And, you know, we're here. And that's huge. Like, that's hardcore food folks. They really, I think, appreciate and get it about eating local food.
Season extension may be one of the hottest trends nationally in local organic farming. But despite their own success, Tutlis and Watts are still both cautious about recommending hoop houses to other farmers. There are still a lot of unknowns, most of all, whether farmers can afford it. Most of the hoop houses in Michigan are subsidized by a Michigan State University research program. And there's also the issue of whether you can find enough people that like to eat kale and other hearty winter greens. Tutlis and Watts say their extended season boxes will always be propped up by beets and potatoes from the previous fall, the kinds of things Michigan localvores have always eaten in the winter. In Traverse City, Michigan, I'm Lou Bluin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, we can put off worrying about the conversion to all digital television until June the 12th. The House approved the slip from February 17th today. The Senate voted last week. The White House says the president will sign the bill when he gets it. Just to be clear here, though, if you get your TV via cable or satellite or pretty much anything other than rabbit ears or an antenna up on the roof, you're going to be all right. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow fell 121 points, 1.5%. The NASDAQ dropped a single point. We'll call that basically flat. The S&P 500 gave up 6 points, 0.75%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Aaron Scott engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, the economy's not so good for retailers, but it is boom time for liquidators.
When the department stores see business slowing, they cancel goods, they push it back onto the manufacturer. In turn, the manufacturer has to find a new outlet for it.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.